This is number 0048, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0048. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File, you'll meet comic and actor Tom Arnold. He talks about his life, his career, and his interest in charity work, like that of his good friend, the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold's a good example. He taught me about the importance of charity work. He said, if my agent doesn't know my charity work as much as he knows my movies, then he's gone. You know, he also said the only reason to have an agent is so there's one person in town that's not bad-mouthing you all the time. I saw the joy early on in the late 80s when I got to know him that he got from doing his stuff. And so I would say, honestly, my greatest joy in life are the times when I'm at my kids' camp or I'm doing this or that, because I'm not thinking about me or what job I'm going to do. I'm playing with the kids and we're having fun and it's not about me.
Robert K. Elder is the author of The Last Words of the Executed. Why write this book?
It was actually simply because no one else had done it. There's sort of no modern study of last words. And the central question in the book is not a political one. I'm neither for or against capital punishment. It simply tries to ask, if these are the most reviled, dangerous members of society, why does it remain a cultural value to record what they say?
Joel DeVev is the creator of the website crapatmyparentshouse.com. He got the idea for the site when he noticed his parents' mantle was covered in Jewish knickknacks with a random model pirate ship in the center.
It was one of those strange moments where I just looked at something and it just seemed off, and I just kind of said to myself, like, what are we, Jewish pirates? My eyes started opening to more things at my parents' house that I just thought was pretty ridiculous.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0048, is Brent Shias, director of television content for Just for Laughs, the Montreal International Comedy Festival. And we'd like to thank Brent for doing the slate on this edition of the show. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? We go to England for our first story, and for some people this might be considered a happy way to die. For others, maybe not. In England, a 30-year-old nanny has died from too much sexual arousal. Nanny Nicola Paginton was found dead in her bed, naked from the waist down, with a porno film running on her laptop and a sex toy next to her. The coroner ruled that Nicola died from a sudden heart arrhythmia, probably brought on by her state of arousal. Her employer called police after she failed to show up for work and went to her home. When there was no reply at the door, she enlisted the help of a neighbor, and they saw Nicola through the curtains, lying on her bed with her cat lying on her chest. After they broke in, they realized Nicola was dead. She had a computer on her lap, and when they moved it and lifted the duvet, they found she was naked from the waist down, and there was a vibrator in the bed. The laptop was still displaying pornographic material. Wow. Your mother always said you'd go blind, but she never said anything about dying, did she? Yeah. On to New Jersey. Authorities say a New Jersey woman lied twice to cover up the theft of a laptop computer, claiming first that she was carjacked, and then that she crashed their car because she was having sex. Authorities say 23-year-old Sarah Blaze of Vineland initially told police that she broke her arm during a carjacking. Police said Blaze later claimed her car crashed into a tree while she was performing a sex act on the man that she had picked up. Camden County Prosecutor spokesperson Jason Laughlin says Blaze and her boyfriend actually stole a laptop computer from a car and slipped away from pursuing police in her car, but then crashed and attempted to set the vehicle on fire. Wow, that's going a long way to come up with some sort of alibi, isn't it? Blaze and 27-year-old Henry Good Jr. face charges including arson, burglary, and hindering apprehension. Authorities say they didn't yet have lawyers. I always liked that charge, hindering apprehension. You know, no one really wants to be caught. That should be just a gimme. Anyway, moving right along, we go to Manchester, New Hampshire. Police say a New Hampshire woman faces several charges after she broke into a home and told the owner she was a police officer after she was discovered in the kitchen. Police say the 34-year-old woman said she was chasing a burglar from the house. When the homeowners asked the woman for identification, she said the burglar had fled with it. Police said the woman pretended to call her sergeant and said she had to go to the station and type up her report and then left. The homeowners wrote down her license plate number and called police. The woman was arrested after a car accident. She was charged with burglary, impersonating a police officer, driving under the influence, and simple assault. Now, let's talk about least competent people, shall we? Jihadists. They blow themselves up by mistake, such as Pakistani terrorist Qari Zafar. He did that in June. They botch airline shoe and underwear bombing and buy the wrong fertilizer for urban car bombs. They brag too much and they watch far too much internet pornography. This is evidence amassed by Daniel Byman and Christine Fair in writing in the July-August issue of The Atlantic, and has led them to suggest that America and its allies should treat jihadists as nitwits rather than as savvy and sophisticated killers, the latter being an image that helps them with recruiting. It is possible, the authors conclude, that there has not been a truly competent jihadist terrorist since Mohammed Atta led the September 11, 2001 missions. Okay, that might be true, but why put that in print and tempt fate? That's all I'm saying. If they're idiots, let's just quietly let them be idiots. Meanwhile, in Shelby County, Tennessee, sheriff's deputies were called to check a woman slumped over the wheel of her car in front of a school. Kelly Moss, age 48, was parked across the sidewalk and arrested for driving under the influence, but she probably had better breath than the average drunk driver. A deputy said her drink of choice seems to be vanilla extract. There were several bottles of the stuff in her car. By the way, it's 35% alcohol. And she smelled strongly of vanilla. It was her third DUI arrest. You'd think a southern girl would prefer mint extract, but I digress. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. On this show, we have another backstage chat from Montreal's Just for Laughs Festival, and it is a very special guest, actor and comic Tom Arnold. Now, you've probably heard or read a lot over the years about Tom, especially in tabloids, and quite a bit of what has been written has been true. But what you don't often hear about Tom is that he's a hardworking, dedicated professional who has carved out a pretty good career for himself. He's talented, very loyal, perhaps to a fault, and the kind of guy you'd probably enjoy hanging around with. Tom has fun at whatever he does, and he appreciates the experiences and also those around him. It was a pleasure to be able to talk to him about his life and career, and here is that conversation with Tom Arnold right now. Tom, you've had a great career so far. You've done over 70 films. You've had a sitcom. You've done stand-up. But I sometimes get the feeling that for some reason in your career, you have to keep explaining yourself to people, to either critics or media, who sometimes don't give you the, quite frankly, the due that you deserve. Do you feel that way?
Well, of course, I feel like, you know, sometimes I overdo it, and people are like, why would you worry? Why do you care? Why do you, you know, don't Google your name. Don't pay attention to critics. You've had enough, whatever, you know. And I do feel very blessed. I mean, I worked at a meatpacking plant for 3 years before I did this, and I've had opportunities with 4 or 5 sitcoms, and I, you know, have had these other things, but sometimes something will, I'll take it more personally than I should. I remember once there was this kid that had a website called Tom Arnold is the Devil, and I read about it, and then I ended up contacting this person. I had no idea about them, you know, and turned out to be a kid that was like 22 and lived in his mother's basement, and he'd had no friends until he had this website called Tom Arnold is the Devil, and now he had a lot of, like 200 friends, and I felt so bad about me, this guy out of nowhere, you know, he's trying to have a little bit of fun, and, you know, I should be able to take that. that's part of the job. And so I was crushing him, and I said, put the site back up. In fact, I'll give you some stuff about proving that I am the devil, and I'll help you get back going. And so I always regret when I say something or do something because it does make me look like an ass, because, you know, I have been blessed and I have been lucky. But you know, also the part of being a comedian or being a performer is I think if everything had gone perfect and, you know, it wasn't, if there weren't so many movies people could make fun of and if there weren't so many opportunities, it wouldn't be as interesting. You know, it's, you know, I'm coming from a place of, you know, a guy that's, you know, just I have definitely survived, you know, a lot worse things in show business before. And also, you know, the fact that I'm still able to work is kind of amazing in a business that, you know, most people aren't given much of a chance. And I'd be able to have chances and screw up and keep getting more chances. And it's because I, you know, I work hard and I know I am very, very lucky. And so, you know.
Yeah, but you keep saying lucky. You're also talented. Let's not leave that out of it. I mean, and I go back to that big theatrical film you had a couple of years ago when people first saw Tom Arnold in a serious role. And I think a lot of people were surprised. And I thought that would have been the film that would have put you over the hump where people would say, yes, let's take Tom Arnold seriously.
Well, there's been, you know, in the films I've done, there's been, I mean, it's been like starting with True Lies. True Lies is a movie, a big Hollywood movie that came out right as my divorce, my first divorce, a very public, ugly mess where everybody said he'll never work again. And then this movie comes out that I'd been working on for a year. And people in Hollywood went, oh, they didn't even know me. Said, oh, maybe he is a decent guy. Not that, you know, they'd ever met me, but I was good in a good movie, right? And so that suddenly made me okay. And so there's been times in my career where I've then done too many movies or, you know, thought, oh, I'll never work yet. I better take all these movies. I better do this. I better do that. And then, you know, I've had to reboot and, you know, maybe do like independent movies that are more, you know, serious. And you know, if you want to work with John Malkovich, you got to do something serious. And through that, you know, what I call the struggle or whatever, you know, because my biggest fear, the first time I did a serious movie was a movie called, that Steve Buscemi directed, called, I'm blanking on the name of it, but Animal Factory. And it was a great movie written by Eddie Bunker and with Mickey Rourke and a bunch of people, Steve and a whole bunch of people, Willem Dafoe, who ended up shivving me. But it was based in a prison. And the fact that I got an opportunity, my fear was people would come to the screening, see me come on as this, you know, this rapist, prison rapist, and then start laughing. But, you know, I got lucky, and they accepted me as a prison rapist, which is, I guess, also not necessarily a compliment. But, you know, I got to work with these great actors in this little movie. And so, you know, and lately a lot of the stuff I've done has been very, very serious and personal to me. And, you know, so I think a lot of comics, people that start off a comedy, it's the old phrase, a comedy is hard, and is true. You know, it is harder than, you know, the dramatic stuff. But I've, you know, if I made a list, if I allowed myself to go and look at my career and the people I've worked with, you know, my first scene in a movie was with Dustin Hoffman in a movie called Hero, which I had no idea how lucky I was. You know, I mean, I was like, you know, and I always, my first wife, I remember I knew her before she was famous. And I knew her, she was coming up, and I always knew how talented she was. And as her friend, it was just so awesome to be a part of that and be able to write a joke or two for her and just follow, you know, watch her rise and watch. And when she went on the Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, and that was her big coming out. And he called her over, and I realized that once I got married to a famous person, I would never have, because you are tainted in a way that you will never, you're already famous. You won't have a coming out. And I thought, well, but it's worth it because I have a wife and stepkids. That's life. And I have these other opportunities. But I went to, we were at the movies and they had the coming attractions from this movie Hero. And I was only in five scenes, but it was pretty much the whole, you know, preview. And I was sitting in there in the theater with my stepkids and my wife and looking around thinking, well, this is my moment. this here with a little family, and you know, that's me with Dustin Hoffman, and maybe it's not Johnny Carson like most comedians dream of, you know what, you know, but that this is my how my life goes.
Well, with all the things you've done, and again, 72 movies, several television shows, now doing stand-up, is there something in your career that you want to do that you haven't had the chance to?
Well, I'm getting ready to do an hour-long stand-up special. And I've done, you know, I did three HBO specials a while back, you know, and but it wasn't stand-up related. You know, it was based on bits and chunks. And it was actually Judd Apatow's first job ever. And I hired him. I'd seen him. I found a lot of guys through stand-up comedy that became writers. And I guess proudest of the fact of that I could recognize talent in others. And I would staff The Roseanne Show and Jackie Thomas and these other shows I did based on, you know, I'd see good comics and I'd say, I can teach you how to write the two-act television script. I can't teach you how to be funny. And so a lot of people got their start via, you know, me. And I you know, it made me look good, obviously. But that's one of the things I'm proudest of. And there's comics here at the that have won Emmys and stuff that you know, I saw them on stage and said, I know this guy's funny. I know he can write. He's going to make me look good. Bring him on. Teach him this little form that we use. But you know, the thing about comics, though, you got to remember is you always got to have a couple old-timers with them because you know, you got to make sure the scripts are done on Thursday, and they aren't quite used to the, you know, with television, you got to have it done. I mean, there's got to have it done. And so, you know, a lot of guys got their starts that way, and, you know, people have been very kind to me, too. So, you know, I always feel like I wish I was in a clique with all the cool kids, and you know, but I wouldn't trade, you know, for as lucky as I've been, I wouldn't trade it.
Well, talking about the cliques, in your stand-up routine, you talk about working on films and the idea of it's a camaraderie and you're friends with those who are in on the screen and on the scenes with. You also mentioned the fact that you're a good friend of the governor of California, mm-hmm. who you also worked with in a film. Mm-hmm. It sounds like one of the things that you truly enjoy, besides the work itself, is the camaraderie and the friendships that come out of working in this business. Would that be a good assessment?
Well, yeah. If it, you know, I got a core group of guys that, you know, that I've been friends with for 20 years and that are, you know, every once in a while I'll meet somebody and eventually get to know them. And, you know, they've been very supportive of me and, you know, they're true friends that, you know, when you're down and it's mostly about that. It's not really about the being in their movies or, you know, working together, although we have, but it's about, you know, when you're down and or they need help with a charity or you need help with a charity or whatever. And, you know, Arnold's a good example. He taught me about the importance of charity work. He said, if my agent doesn't know my charity work as much as he knows my movies, then he's gone. You know, and he also said the only reason to have an agent is so there's one person in town that's not bad-mouthing you all the time. So, but I took it. I saw the joy early on in the late 80s when I got to know him that he got from doing this stuff. And so I would say, honestly, my greatest joy in life are the times when I'm at my kids' camp or I'm doing this or that because I'm not thinking about me or what job I'm going to do. You know, I'm, you know, playing with the kids and we're having fun and we're, you know, it's not about me. And it's also very inspirational when, you know, a kid that's had two heart transplants at 7 years old is, you know, climbing the rock wall before me and, you know, kayaking and having, and you know, living in the moment. You know, I worry about things that are so stupid sometimes, you know, I constantly am worried that, you know, people make a lot of jokes and have a lot of fun at my expense. But, you know, if I wasn't, you know, the flip side, if I wasn't so well known, they couldn't, you know, make that. And so it's funny, last week on Monday, I got a call last week ago Friday, the week ago for today, actually, that from Tom Cruise that he wanted to do a table reading for a script. And that, to me, that's a big honor. That's like playing with the cool kids. And Will Smith's producing it. And they had a bunch of big actors there and had this table read. And then afterwards, people filmed it outside, you know, the paparazzi. And they were calling it a Scientology meeting and whatever. And I just thought to myself, You know, this guy, there's nobody nicer than Tom Cruise or Will Smith. I mean, seriously, and nobody funnier than Will. He's the funniest dude. He could, you know, he could do the Eddie Murphy thing. He could do concerts. He could do whatever. And, you know, people are trying to make this something weird out of this. I also thought if I were Tom Cruise and, you know, being a comedian, I would use all that material. You know, I would not let, you know, people make snarky remarks. I would take a hold of it. And that's my goal is when I hear people make fun of me, I think, why didn't I think of that? Why didn't I get the joke?
Well, I have to say this, and I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but I've been watching you on stage for the last couple of days here in Montreal. I've seen you interact with the comics backstage, seen you interact with the crew, with the people who work here. And I don't know if you've seen the movie Up, but there's the dog in Up who just wants to please, who just wants the friendship of the people around him, and that's what I see in you, and you seem like the happiest person when you're on stage. And I think that's a joy, not just for yourself, but the audience gets it too. So on behalf of the audience, I'd like to thank you for all you've done.
I think it's when I'm bonding with the audience, it is real. I mean, I feel like I owe them. You know, when they come to my, since I started touring a year ago, the fact they would spend their hard-earned money and come out to a show to see me, you know, is just, it just freaks me out. And so, you know, of course I'm going to stay around and hang out. And I think it's the good news and the bad news. I'm not Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise. I mean, if you saw them in an airport, you'd be like, oh my God, that's, but if they see, if a person sees me, they're like, oh my God, it's my cousin Tom Arnold. I've got to go up and punch him in the arm or, you know, talk. And so there's definitely a connection that he's one of us, and that's, you know, that's all I'd ever want, you know, and to be able to tell stories from an outsider's perspective, which is what I do in my act, you know, because people know my history. I can't lie and say I just got married for the first time and whatever's going on, you know, and I just talk about my mistakes and my positives. I sense that people are genuinely happy that I'm in a good marriage. They you know, are happy that I'm not a jerk towards my ex-wives, you know, that I have some gratitude for everything that's happened. And, I think it gives people relief. I think that people, a lot of times, they care about the people in Los Angeles and New York. And between there is a lot of America, you know, a lot of real folks. And those are the people that, you know, if you make fun of somebody too much, if you make fun of George W. Bush or Sarah Palin too much, they'll elect a president because they think you're making fun of them. And I think that's probably what happens with me, too.
Well, I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, Tom. It's a pleasure to have you on the program with us.
Well, it's been great working with you at this festival. You've made it a lot better for me, and thank you very much.
That was a chat with actor and comic Tom Arnold. We could have chatted forever because Tom was just such a warm and giving individual, but we both had work to do backstage, so that chat had to come to an end. I've mentioned this on the program before, and this is one of the reasons I love working backstage at Just for Laughs. You get to hang out and really talk with kind, talented folks like Tom Arnold. By the way, you can check out Tom's website at tomarnoldcomedy.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, and again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0048, and you'll find links to Tom's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avadale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well,
I guess she just doesn't love you.
Still to come on the program, we'll meet the author of Last Words of the Executed, plus the creator of the website crapatmyparentshouse.com, and of course there is an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff right here. You know, universal health care insurance cannot come soon enough for uninsured Kathy Myers, age 41, of Niles, Michigan, who is suffering an increasingly painful shoulder injury. And she has been continually turned away from emergency rooms because the condition is not life-threatening. Well, in June, as a last resort, she took a gun and shot herself in the shoulder, hoping for a wound serious enough for ER treatment. Alas, she missed major arteries and bones and was sent home again, except with even more pain. Ouch. Meanwhile, in Las Cruces, New Mexico, losing a drinking bet meant a 47-year-old man's friends set his prosthetic leg on fire. Nice friends. The poor guy was also suffering severe burns to his buttocks and lower back because of the incident. Sheriff's deputies found the man naked on the side of U.S. Route 70 with his prosthetic leg in flames. The bet was whoever drank the least would be set on fire. Our friend downed only 6 beers, the least of anyone in the group, so agreed to let his friends set him on fire. Idiot boy later took his clothes off because of the pain, and his friends decided to take him to the hospital. But they got nervous and instead dropped him off on the side of the highway. As I said before, some friends. Police took him to a burn treatment center. And, you know, any story that contains the line, "and then they found 2 pieces of bacon in the closet," has got to be a good one, don't you think? In South Bend, Indiana, a dispute over the ownership of a frying pan led to third-degree burns of one man and 11 stitches for another. A 49-year-old man was cooking bacon on the stove at his house when his 47-year-old brother-in-law claimed the pan was his. The argument led to the man cooking cornering the younger man in the closet and spilling hot grease on the younger man. The report said the 47-year-old then grabbed the frying pan from his attacker and hit him in the head twice. Yes, twice. The 49-year-old was taken to an area hospital where he received 11 stitches before being arrested for assault. But the man who received third-degree burns on his hands told police he did not wish to press charges. Police searched the premises, and wait for it, here's that line, "and then found 2 pieces of bacon in the closet." Yes. If I had a nickel for every time I've said that sentence, I'd have a nickel. On to Sydney, Australia. An Australian man dubbed Crocodile Dumb D for trying to ride a huge crocodile after a drinking spree described how he just wanted to play with the animal. Michael Newman, age 36, said he climbed into the enclosure of Fatso, that's the name of a 5-yard saltwater croc who lives at a northern wildlife park. He wanted to get into the enclosure and pat him and then sit on his back. This is a quote. "I thought to myself, well, I will jump the fence and go from behind its tail and pat on his back and then sit on him." That's what Newman told the public broadcaster ABC in Australia. "And within like 1 split second before I even slightly touched its back, it already had me by the leg," he said. Media reports said Newman tried to drip beer into the mouths of 2 female crocodiles before moving on to the giant Fatso. He said he shouted at Fatso to let him go before escaping from the pen and returning to a nearby pub with severe leg injuries, where he drank a beer while waiting for an ambulance. That's dedication for you. But Newman, who has been recovering in hospital after undergoing surgery from his bite wounds, vowed never to approach a crocodile again. Good call. Broome Crocodile Park owner Malcolm Douglas has credited Newman's escape to relatively cold conditions, with the temperature falling to 22 degrees Celsius or 71 degrees Fahrenheit overnight. That's not that cold, really. "They're cold-blooded animals, so their reflexes slow down," he was quoted as saying. So, there you go. Meanwhile, in Smithfield, Utah, Jennifer Wilhite and Anna Hansen are sisters, so you'd think they'd be a little used to teasing each other. Well, apparently not. It seems Anna got herself some nice big breast implants, and her sister Jennifer sent her a joking text message saying she could now apply for a job at Hooters. Ha, 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 ha. There's a knee slapper for you. Anna was so inexplicably offended, she actually charged her sister with telephone harassment. So Jen was arrested and charged with a Class B misdemeanor. A bench trial was originally set for July 9th, but Anna finally dropped the charges last week. Jennifer said her sister most likely dropped the charges due to publicity of the case. In other words, Anna finally woke up and realized the entire world was thinking, "You're the biggest jerk on the planet." So, there you go. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest, Chase Fitzgerald, age 24, was perplexed when his key wouldn't open the door of his Jeep Cherokee, which he had parked in the bank's lot in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. So naturally, he used a concrete block to smash the window, and then realized it wasn't his Jeep. Police cited him for criminal mischief after assessing the damages at $2,555. Nice going, pal. Nice going. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Talk about diehard devotion. Some death row convicts use their last words to root for their favorite football team. So says Robert K. Elder, who researched the final words of those sentenced to death for his new book, Last Words of the Executed, which is published by University of Chicago Press. Robert is on the line with us right now. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. Interesting concept for a book, and kind of ghoulish, too. What made you decide to chronicle the last words of those on death row?
It was actually simply because no one else had done it. There's sort of no modern study of last words, and the central question in the book, this is not a political one. I'm neither for or against capital punishment. It simply tries to ask, if these are the most reviled, dangerous members of society, why does it remain a cultural value to record what they say?
So why does it remain a cultural value to record what they say?
Well, I sort of leave that open to the reader. And the additional question I'm interested in is, what can we learn from them? Everybody brings away a different lesson, but what I learned is you sort of get the full view of humanity through last words. You get people who, you know, are angry. Many of the words fit within the five stages of grief, you know, which are anger, acceptance, denial, that sort of thing. And again, like you said, at least four people choose to cheer for their favorite football team.
Wow. Now, is it possible that we as a society just believe deep down inside somewhere that at the core everybody is good or decent, and maybe last words is some sort of redemption?
I think that's a little bit of it, yeah. I think you are showing deference or respect, or at least that's some of the thinking behind it. Folks who are anti-death penalty would say it's a way to assuage a little bit of our own guilt. But again, those arguments are there to be had.
Now, how did you collect this information, and have you had the opportunity to actually hear someone's last words?
Yes, I've heard someone's last words, not in person, thank goodness, but the state of Georgia records their last words, and some of them are available on various documentaries, but I have no real desire to see an execution myself. Mm. The methodology of the book is sort of multi-layered. I went to prison archives all across the U.S. I also did a lot of newspaper research and talked to people who actually took last words. So I tried to get as many sources to cobble together the most complete, accurate book I could.
Now, when you say actually took last words, is there some sort of ceremonial process? Is this when a person is strapped into whatever device it is that carts them into the next level? How exactly is this done?
Well, it's done differently in each state. But, for example, the gentleman I talked to in Texas, his name is Reverend Carol Pickett, and Reverend Pickett would spend the final 24 hours with the condemned. And, he would spend that time talking with them and consoling them and advising them. And then at a certain point in the proceedings, they would say, okay, do you have any last words? And this is before they're actually in the death chamber. And it's sort of a rehearsal, actually, because they want people to be a little clear about what they want to say. And it also has another function, and that is they want to make sure they don't cut anybody off.
I guess.
Yeah.
So in putting this book together, what was the form that it took? Is it just name, last words, name, last words, or is there a narrative that goes with it?
Well, it's a little bit of a narrative, because what I wanted to do is show how the ritual of taking last words and the words themselves changed over the last 350 years, because I go all the way back to pre-colonial times for the U.S., which is in the middle of the 1600s. It's basically arranged by method of execution, which is somewhat chronological, but it goes the noose, firing squad, electric chair, gas chamber, and then, of course, lethal injection. And, you know, that's somewhat chronological. There's a little bit of overlap, but within there you really get a scope of the history because, you know, when execution was a public event, there was a sense of oration. There was a sense of people giving a speech. And then when you ended up with more sort of private executions, when execution chambers became private matters behind prison walls, you end up with people speaking directly to people on the other side of the glass, whether that's their own family or victims' families. So it's a very different sense of intimacy.
Do you in any way, shape, or form chronicle the reaction that the last words get from those who witness the execution?
Yeah, we get a little taste of that. Like I said, I wanted to sort of be as even-handed as possible. So you have family members of the victims reacting. You have the family members of the executed themselves reacting. One woman says, you know, someone who took the life of her sister, you know, he was the sociopath the entire time, and he was ruthless and boasted about being a serial killer, but that was not present at all in his last words. So, you know, you get sort of these multidimensional views of people.
I understand some people actually crack jokes just before they go.
Yes, actual gallows humor. Yes, and many of it not actually on the gallows. I mean, there are a couple of gentlemen. One who is facing a firing squad. They said, "Yes, do you have any last requests?" And he says, "Yes, I'd like a bulletproof vest, please." There's also a gentleman who is on death row and in the electric chair. And again, same question. Do you have any last requests? And he says, yes, I want my lawyer on my lap. So, again, that's a little bit more angry, but there are jokes like that. There's also a gentleman named Frederick Wood who was also electrocuted in the middle of the 1900s. And he said, gentlemen, you're about to see a scientific experiment. The experiment of the effects electricity has on wood.
Now, I started off by mentioning people rooting for their favorite football team. I understand among some of those who've done this, Robert, is it Comer?
Yes, correct.
Who said, go Raiders, just before his lethal injection. Have you heard anything from the Raiders?
No, and it's actually really strange. I think two people cheer for the Raiders, one for the Dallas Cowboys, and one for the Cleveland Browns. Out of 16,000 executions we've had on these shores, again, since 1608, not a single cheer for a baseball team, for a hockey team, for any other sport. It's just football. So I don't know what that says about the inmate population.
Wow, interesting indeed. An interesting concept for a book, too. The book is called Last Words of the Executed, and people can check out the website, which is lastwordsoftheexecuted.com. What will they find at the website, Robert?
You'll find excerpts from the book. Also, Studs Terkel, who is a friend and mentor, wrote the introduction. He actually passed away while we were editing the book, so it was a sadness of mine that he never got to see it, but folks would know him. He did, you know, those great oral histories like Working and The Good War, and was just a tremendous gentleman. Also, Sister Helen Prejean calls my book dangerous, which is nice, I guess.
She calls it dangerous? Why?
Yeah, this is a dangerous book. You know, that was her blurb on the back cover. and the joke is, you know, I didn't know if I wanted to spend 7 years of my life on a book to have a nun call it dangerous. And then every day I post a new historical last word. So every day when you come to the website, you can read what somebody else had to say historically. I also tweet. It also doubles as a tweet at Last Words X every day.
I was actually going to ask that question. This could be the next step with social networking, where someone is going to say, some state is going to say, do you have any final tweets?
Yes. Although I think by the time we get to that, it'll be something else. You know, it's the, you know, Friendster begets MySpace begets, you know, LinkedIn begets, you know, whatever. So it'll be whatever the next Facebook, Twitter, social media thing is.
The book is called Last Words of the Executed. It's written by Robert K. Elder. And I thank you, Rob, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks for having me.
Robert K. Elder, author of Last Words of the Executed, published by University of Chicago Press. You can check out Robert's website at lastwordsofthexecuted.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you can go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0048. And you'll find links to Robert's site and also either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Terrestrial radio is basically going to be supplanted by what's happening in technology. This new technology, it's remarkable. You're going to see in your automobiles internet receivers instead of radios. Our cell phones are going to become fundamentally our computers.
Download every film ever made in 4 minutes. 3D is coming. It's amazing.
We're going to have a dramatic increase someplace down the road. When you get your internet receiver, that gives you the entire world.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide broadcasting system.
This is the future of radio.
Get to where you want to be in the change in technology.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the creator of crapatmyparentshouse.com. Plus, we, of course, have an idiot of the day. But first, a few more Stuff File stories to get you there. And both of these stories really deal with people with anger management issues. First up, Vanessa Marty, age 23, of New York, took her two young children to visit their father in Jersey City, New Jersey. She then asked to use his cell phone, and he handed it to her. Marty then went through his phone log, then called and yelled at his new girlfriend. The man grabbed the phone back and locked himself in his bedroom, but Marty kicked down the door. Boy, she's, again, really got some anger management issues. He then ran out into the hall, and Marty allegedly pulled a 9mm pistol out of the baby carriage and shot at him. She missed. She ran, but was arrested nearby and charged with weapons violations and child endangerment. And note to jailers, when she asks for her one phone call, watch her carefully. And another issue of anger management, a gas station attendant in Surprise, Arizona, found a man unconscious in a truck parked in the station's lot. He knocked on the man's window, and the man woke up and started screaming. The attendant called police. Officers arrived to find William Meadows, age 47, still screaming and acting violently, so the officer, thinking Meadows might be having a reaction to drugs, called for paramedics. Meadows allegedly bit a paramedic and, once at the hospital, punched a nurse. Doctors found no evidence of drugs or alcohol in his system, so Meadows was arrested and charged with aggravated assault and disorderly conduct. So what was he so upset about? He told the officer that the gas station attendant had interrupted a very good dream when he knocked on the window. Wow. A very good dream. Yeah, he'll have different dreams in jail, I'm sure. Actually, maybe even some nightmares.
Anyway, let's get to our final guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, parents always have the weirdest stuff stashed away at their houses. That's what Brooklyn-based comedian Joel DeVevre realized one day when he visited his mom and dad and noticed their mantle covered with Jewish knickknacks with a random model pirate ship at the center. He created the website crapatmyparentshouse.com. Joel is on the line with us right now. Hi, Joel. How are you?
Good, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you only realized this was odd when you went to visit your parents? You hadn't noticed this before?
I hadn't. It was one of those strange moments where I just looked at something and it just seemed off. And I just kind of said to myself, like, what are we, Jewish pirates? And I just, my eyes started opening to more things at my parents' house that I just thought was pretty ridiculous.
Now, at the time when you first saw this, did you think, gosh, my parents are weird? Or when did the realization come to you that, you know, other people's parents are probably like this too?
You know, I've always thought my parents are pretty strange, so that didn't come as a surprise. I was surprised. What happened was I kind of just took about 10 or 12 pictures of things at my parents' house, and I put it on my Facebook page, and people just responded really positively to it, so I just kind of went forward with that.
Now, that's one of the interesting things about this day and age, with social networking, with websites, with blogs, with Facebook, with Twitter, and all the like. Would you think that parents, and maybe even your own parents, would be mortified at the idea that this stuff is suddenly out there online?
You know, I told my mother about the idea, and she was adamantly against it. She forbade me from doing it, but I'm pretty stubborn when it comes to these things. So I did it anyways, and I called her, and I showed her the site, and she was laughing hysterically at it and kind of gave me her blessing. And I've had a couple other emails from parents that were a little angry, and I kind of just told them about the idea, and they saw the site, and everyone has kind of come around to it, where I have now parents that hated the idea are now telling their friends about it.
So besides your parents with the random model pirate ship up there, what are the other things that you've discovered about other people's parents who have put stuff up on your website that are kind of weird?
You know, it's funny. Everyone has something, and it doesn't have to be one of those things that's so bizarre. I find that just kind of subtle things are humorous. For example, someone submitted yesterday a magnet that says "World's Best Grandpa" on their fridge, but no one in that house is a grandfather. And you kind of just start looking at things with a different eye. I mean, everybody has weird stuff in their garage, but I find more of the stuff in common areas to be pretty hilarious.
Okay, so with the website, is there a little bit of history with each item? For instance, let's look at your house. What is the deal with the model pirate ship?
You know, I don't really know. It was right after I saw the model pirate ship, my mom kind of yelled at me from the other room to go downstairs into just kind of a refrigerator in the basement, and she wanted me to get something from the freezer. So I opened the freezer. It was packed full of meat, and I opened up the refrigerator part. And there was one nearly empty bottle of Manischewitz wine, and it was just hysterical. And you know, I don't know. There's just a gold mine. I haven't been home since I took those initial pictures, and I'm pretty excited to find more weird crap.
So, what about others? Are people on the site at least giving some explanation, or is this just a site where people go take a look and continually scratch their heads?
You know, there's some explanations. This morning I posted. Someone had like a dummy, I guess you'd call it. I guess the explanation was, this is what my father uses to get my brother to eat his vegetables, and it's like a terrifying looking like mannequin, I guess.
Sort of like a ventriloquist. I saw that. I saw that on the site. It's sort of like a ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. Thank you. You know, sometimes there's explanations. Sometimes there's people just submit a photo. I think it's kind of people are a little scared to give too much detail and let people realize how crazy their family actually is.
Is there some sort of theme that's developing? And by that I mean, I know that there are some things like stuffed animals, things of nature. Is there a theme that seems to be showing up on these pictures and these sites?
You know, I don't know yet. I've been getting a lot of owl submissions. A lot of people's parents have weird owls everywhere. There's two up right now, and I have about 10 that I haven't posted. So maybe that's a theme. I don't know. I think what's great about the site and what people really enjoy is that it's just everything and anything.
Okay, so let's be honest. You're an adult. You're also a comedian. If I took a camera...
myself.
If I took a camera to your house, what would I find there that's weird?
I have a large Jean-Claude Van Damme poster in my bedroom that I picked up in Spain that I think is pretty weird. I don't know. That's a good question. I guess it's hard to kind of look at yourself and see all the weird stuff that you have.
A Jean-Claude Van Damme poster in your bedroom, does that attract the ladies?
You know what? It does. Girls love the JCVD, so that's just how it works out.
So your parents have now forgiven you for what you've done. Are they offering up other things to put up on your site?
My mom. What's funny is my mom, being a comedian, my mom kind of calls me almost on a weekly basis to tell me things that I should do in my act, and usually they're not very funny. Just, you know, a tomato was in the apple section at the grocery store, and I should turn that into a bit. Her sensibilities, I think, are spot on with this. She kind of sent me a picture with a bunch of books, and it was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was like four copies of the Da Vinci Code on the bookshelf. My dad, however, is a little oblivious to what I'm doing. He just kind of, I told him what it was, and he seems kind of disinterested, so we'll see.
He hasn't realized the popularity of the net and probably just thinks a few of your friends are looking at photos?
Yeah, I think he just kind of was like, all right, you're going to take pictures and put it on your Facebook page. You know, someday he'll realize it when he sees his stuff on the site.
Someone listening to this right now, if they say, if they go to the site, which is crap@myparentshouse.com, if they want to submit something, how do they go about doing so?
There's a bunch of ways. They can. There's a submit button where they can upload photos directly, or they can email me, crapsmyparentshouse@gmail.com, which is also on the site.
Excellent. And I mentioned that you're a comic. Tell us a little bit about your career. How long have you been working as a comic?
That's a good question. I've been a comedian and a comedy writer for about 7 years. I started in San Francisco in a sketch comedy troupe called Killing My Lobster, and I performed sketch and improv and stand-up throughout New York and hopefully other places sooner.
Well, continued success both with your career and also the site. Again, the site is crap@myparentshouse.com. Thank you very much, Joel, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Joel DeVev, creator of the website crap@myparentshouse.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is 0048, and you'll find links to Joel's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
This is The Stuff File.
And before we wrap things up completely on this edition of The Stuff File program, we have one more item to deal with, and that, of course, would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
And we find this idiot in Florida, a Florida woman accused of starting an office fire to get sent home early with pay, pleaded guilty to criminal mischief. The Pasco County Sheriff's Office said Michelle Perino, age 40, drew suspicion during a meeting of the Bayonet Point Oxygen employees when she mentioned the May 12th fire had started in a filing cabinet before workers had been informed of the fire's origins. Investigators said a friend of Perino told them she had admitted to tripping the main circuit breaker and adjusting phones to block incoming calls in bids to go home early without sacrificing a day's pay. Perino was sentenced to 9 months imprisonment, followed by 5 years of probation. She was also ordered to pay Bayonet Point Oxygen $4,800 in restitution and banned from contacting the company or its employees. So why would someone set a fire just to get out of work early? One reason, and one reason only. She's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0048. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests on the What's On page. Just go to the corresponding program number, and again, this show is number 0048. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder, and on Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, streaming on PCJMedia.com, and over the air on World FM 88.2 in New Zealand and Gold FM 90.5 in Singapore. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.